welcome listeners to the Gila Members Community Radio Show, Earth Matters. Earth Matters brings you in-depth coverage of local, state, and national environmental issues, and we want to inform, challenge, engage, and inspire our listeners. Three hosts alternate weekly shows to bring you a broad range of topics and expertise. Your host today is me, Dr. Kim McCrary, Southwest Regional Director and Staff Scientist of the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. The New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, also known by some as NM Wild, is a grassroots organization dedicated to protecting and restoring New Mexico's wild places through advocacy and education and legislative designations. Today's show is about Mexican wolves and the recovery program in the Gila region. As mandated by the Endangered Species Act, critically endangered Mexican wolves are reintroduced to the Southwest in 1998. Now, the program's been mired in lots of controversy ever since, and who better to discuss the resulting misinformation and disinformation with than today's guest, Nancy Kaminsky. Now, Nancy's been involved in wolf conservation education and advocacy for some 33 years, and specifically with Mexican wolves for the last decade. So I'd like to say welcome to the show, Nancy.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, listen, before we start talking about Mexican wolves and the recovery program, I wanted to ask you what inspired you to get involved in wolf conservation education and advocacy, particularly because I know that you've done a tremendous amount of volunteer work.
Actually, I grew up in Wisconsin on a dairy farm in a wonderful Swiss community, and my relatives always instilled in me a love of the natural world. As my siblings left the farm, it forced us to move into the city, Madison, Wisconsin, during the 60s. And we were two blocks off of State Street in downtown Madison. So often a walk to high school could end me in a protest of the Vietnam police action. So I learned how to peacefully protest on top of the love of the natural world. Wolves had been extirpated from the United States, the only place there were any wolves left in by the mid-60s probably, was the Arrowhead region of Minnesota. And then in 1979, they returned to Wisconsin on their own. We did not have to reintroduce them. At that point, I volunteered with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources to work for the wolves, which I thought should have been there all along. I remember as a small child being able to hear them howl in southern Wisconsin, and I always thought that they should return. So as a volunteer, we worked on education and outreach at first, trying to get people to respond positively to this new predator. Just like down here, we had our issues. There were, of course, depredations. There was a lot of cows in Wisconsin. And Wisconsin handled that by creating an endangered species license plate. And the money raised through that license plate paid for all the depredations. It was a pretty good solution since it was the people in the large cities who really wanted the wolves back, and yet it was the rural communities that had to deal with the wolves. So the rural cattle growers were really being rewarded by the people who wanted them there the most. It was a good solution, and it works today.
And again, this was in Wisconsin,
In
correct?
Wisconsin, yes. And Wisconsin is smaller than New Mexico. There's more people, there's more cows, and there are now over 750 timber wolves in Wisconsin. It's worked out pretty well. At this point, the wolves are going to come off the endangered species list, and they're going to be lethally controlled. But I think at some point we probably have to do that. With that many wolves and that many people, we'll probably come to a point where we have to manage them.
So that leads me to my next question. Why does it even matter that Mexican wolves are restored to the landscape at all? I mean, why should people even care?
Well, as a lover of wildlands, I got to speak on behalf of their entirety. Growing up in Wisconsin, we often went into Canada. Northern regions of Canada have all the wildlife still there. The wolves are there, moose, caribou, everything you could possibly imagine is still there. So our trips into Canada were exciting and wonderful, and the wild lands were all there in their entirety. And I think that's what I need, and probably most people need. They're not looking for that, you know, walk in the city park when they go out to the wilderness. They need the predators there as well as everything else. Science taught me a lot about the web of life, and I really do believe that when you take out pieces, you've destroyed it in its entirety.
Well, I've heard it said by some that Mexican wolves never lived in the Southwest at all, and also that they're actually a hybrid subspecies in this case. Now, based on the science, is either one of these beliefs true?
I don't think so. I study a lot of science of wolves in general. And of course, 11 years ago when I moved to New Mexico, I studied the lobo. And from all records, we found that they originally were distributed from south of Mexico City, well into Texas, most of Arizona, and New Mexico. They've always been here. When we wanted to bring them back from the brink of extinction, we sent a trapper down to Mexico, and he could still find five. I think he found five down there. There weren't many, but they've always been here. They're not hybrids. The Endangered Species Act would never allow us to reintroduce a hybrid. There's a specific species survival plan for every endangered species. It requires genetic testing to make sure the animal that we're putting on the land is the same one that should have been there all along. Any animal who even, you know, would have a hybrid litter, the litter would be destroyed. There's no chance that hybrids would be reintroduced or even allowed to stay on the land. It's just not going to happen.
And in fact, there have been wolves in the Gila area that have been searching for mates and haven't been able to find a mate, and they've ended up breeding with domestic dogs. And am I correct that when that's happened, these litters have actually been destroyed to ensure that we do have a pure genetic strain?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's only happened twice that I recall. And the first wolf, of course, they knew right away the litter was hybrid. They destroyed the litter. And that wolf eventually found a Mexican wolf mate and went on to produce purebred litters. Another one that had been released in the Gila, in the northeastern portion of the Gila, was alone. There was no other wolf there to mate with. She couldn't find a male. And so she bred with domestic dogs, and that litter was also destroyed.
Now, there has been considerable press about the Mexican wolf recovery program, and much of it seems to be framed in terms of livestock producers versus environmentalists. I know you've worked in wolf country here with all different stakeholders as well as agency folks involved in the program. Do you think that this is an accurate snapshot of what is actually going on in the field?
Oh, I don't think so at all. After being involved for so many years, I realize that there's been times of great conflict. When we first began the program, there may have been some mistakes about how to handle the outreach and education. I would have done much more initially before putting the animals on the land. And so there always was a lot of misconceptions about the wolves, what they'll do and what they won't do. But I don't think it's a matter of us versus them. Some people might choose to go down that path, but I don't think that's the only one. Many people have worked together, agencies and, I hate to call them environmentalists, but how about pro-wolf people? Not all livestock growers within the lobo's homeland are against wolves. We don't hear much about livestock growers that work with us and tolerate the wolves, but believe me, they are out there. We all deal with them. We work with them every day. Kim from New Mexico Wild probably knows a lot about this because that's one of the things they try to do is work with ranchers. There have been times at meetings during the past 10 years where I felt as though I didn't have a friend in the room. And part of the reason was that I seemed to be always trying to build bridges and there seemed to be people who didn't care much for my building bridges. But in the past 5 years, that has changed. I find a lot more people that are willing to work with us.
Well, we're going to take a break, and we'll be right back. Welcome, listeners, back to Earth Matters, and we're here today with Nancy Kaminsky. Nancy Kaminsky has been involved in wolf conservation and education, as well as advocacy, for some 33 years. And we're right now talking about how different stakeholders are working together in the Gila to try and make Mexican wolf recovery a success, which is something, in fact, a message that we do not hear very often in the press. So, Nancy, if we can take it up from where we left off, I'd like to know why you think it is that there isn't more coverage of the collaboration that is actually going on in the Gila.
Oh, that's a really good question. I'm not sure. From all the people that I deal with, you know, we have a small audience of really active wolf lovers who keep up on the information. But I think if you don't go to the websites and you don't belong to any of the groups that support wolves, you might not be able to find this information. It's not going to be in the newspaper very often. Newspapers and other media sources usually go for the sensational aspect of things. And I don't think it's very sensational when we're out there putting up fences. And one of the greatest fences is Fladry, which is stunning to me that wolves would actually be afraid of a small wire fence with some flags hanging off of it. But it works. We've found a lot of things over the years that work in deterring wolves from eating people's livestock. One of the wonderful things in counties where it's often economically a hardship to live there, if we can hire local people to go out there and herd the cows, that's wonderful. The fences I've talked about, the ability to rotate the cattle away from dens. A lot of this we didn't have to do in Wisconsin because, of course, we have dairy farms in Wisconsin. But the husbandry practices in the Southwest are considerably different. And so the ability just to rotate the cows away from den sites is remarkably successful. And many people, many of the livestock growers within Mexican wolf territory use this method. They're more than willing to have the help. If we could support the Forest Service more in the ability to move these cows away from dens, it would be a great help. For years now, what we've been doing is paying the livestock growers for depredations. After the cow's been killed, if it's confirmed to be a wolf kill, we give that rancher fall market value for the cow. I haven't always supported that, because coming from a dairy farm in Wisconsin, I understand that that isn't always going to cover all his losses. The cow might not have been going to fall market value. If the cow was 2 years on pasture, she probably had another 4 years to deliver calves. So should we be paying that rancher for six or seven cows? And what would the fall market value be in 5 or 6 years? So it wasn't always a great program, and we've struggled with it. There's a new one being proposed, and I wish I could give you all the specifics, but I haven't read all the paperwork yet. And it looks to me as if it's a program that would reward people for tolerance of the wolves. If the wolves are denning on your property, you would actually be paid if those wolves survived and thrived. I think that would be a much better way than just paying for dead cows.
Well, you know, since we are talking about livestock losses due to wolves, I need to ask you, are wolves a major cause of losses of livestock?
Actually, no. Not in Wisconsin or in New Mexico. Cows are pretty fragile creatures, actually. We always had difficulty keeping them really, really healthy with the extreme husbandry practices that we used on the dairy farms. So here in New Mexico, where they're often left out to pasture for some time, it's very difficult to keep them healthy. So the number one cause of cattle deaths is health problems. The upper respiratory diseases found in cattle take most of the livestock in New Mexico. But health issues are actually 82% of all cattle losses. Weather is another tough one on the cows. 12% of all cows die from the weather-related issues. Predators take a really small percentage of cows. They get a lot of press, but they don't really count for many deaths. And wolves are way down on the list. The Mexican wolves take 0.2% of all losses. The only thing lower than the wolves on the loss column is bears. Coyotes and domestic dogs take more. I don't know how we can ever get this out to the general public other than a wonderful radio station like this, but these kind of figures all seem dry and they don't get a lot of press.
Well, then it makes me wonder, and I'd just like to throw this out to you to see what you have to say, because I've had mixed responses when I proposed this before. Given that health problems cause more cattle deaths than anything else, I'm wondering why someone doesn't consider having a veterinarian care fund that ranchers could dip into if they agreed to allow wolves on their land as well as their grazing allotments, which are on public lands. Have you ever talked to anyone about that, or what are your thoughts?
I really haven't talked to anyone about that, but I think it's a great idea. I absolutely think it's wonderful. The more ways I think that we find to help the cattle growers who are out there on the actual land, the more tolerance we're going to get. I like the cooperative sense there is to that proposal.
Another thing that I wanted to talk to you about, and this is kind of something I heard as a rumor, and that is that unfortunately sometimes in the wolf recovery area, there are ranchers that do try to do those things that minimize wolf depredations. And I recently heard a story about a rancher, this happened last year, where he was more than willing to have pay some local folks. He was actually offered financial assistance to pay some local folks to go out there and watch his cattle because there was a pack in the area. He agreed with that, and several days later, he changed his mind. And that, of course, suggests that there might be a bit of pressure placed on that rancher. And I have, in fact, talked to other people that have said the same thing. And given that you've spent many hours out in the field and that you do, in fact, talk to a lot of ranchers, you know, what is it that you've heard about this sort of thing when it comes to pressure, local pressure, to not cooperate?
I wish I could say that wasn't true, but I'm afraid there's a bit of that. In any community, there's going to be some pressure from people to get you to conform to their idea of what's right or what's normal. I'm sad to say that happens, but it does. There's some people who really resist any form of change, and it makes it a little difficult to deal with this program when you run into so many people who refuse any amount of help and wouldn't change. The blessings are that they're the minority. They're kind of loud and they have some power here in New Mexico, but they are still the minority.
Well, Nancy, a few minutes ago, you provided our listeners with some statistics on the primary causes of cattle losses. And I just was wondering where those statistics came from.
Oh, this livestock producers reports from the United States Department of Agriculture. I think those reports were last updated in 2011, so they're pretty current. And there haven't been a lot of depredations this year. I think a lot of that is due to the fires. Not everybody believes fires are good, but they do have their good sides. And one of them is that the cattle were removed from large areas, and the wolves stayed. Without the cattle there was less depredations.
Okay, so when we consider the statistics that you provided, and we see that wolves are not responsible for a lot of the losses, I have, though, heard, and that's on average, all right? So that's an average across the entire lower 48th. But if you're talking about the individual rancher, And let's just say that this person has a pack denning on his private land or on his grazing allotment, his or her grazing allotment on public lands. If you've got a pack there, that I am correct that that particular rancher could take some hits there. So it might cause a problem for the individual, although on average, it really, wolves don't cause much of a problem. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. One of the things we found when the wolves first came back in Wisconsin was that oftentimes they would target one place. One farm was repeatedly depredated. And for some reason, and we're not quite sure, this wasn't even near a den. So for some reason, they choose a ranch and they pick on it. In those kind of cases, we really need to do proactive work to save that rancher, his cows, his livelihood. You know, from a farming family in Wisconsin, I tell you, the margin is usually pretty small on what you make by raising cows.
And again, in fact, you're saying, based on your experience in the field, that there are people out there that are working to minimize those losses for those individual ranchers, and there are, in fact, those individual ranchers that are willing to work with people to do so.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. We've seen it repeatedly. If a woman with a goat farm finds that she can sight wolves regularly, and the IFT, the interagency field team, really gets out there to work on the outreach and makes people in the Lobos territories understand that they could be visited by a wolf. And they usually give them all the information to contact the IFT. And so if they see a wolf, I'm thinking of one woman in particular that has a goat farm. She called the IFT right away. She sighted the wolf. It was obviously kind of curious about her operation. And before the wolf depredated a single one of her livestock, they were there. They put up fences, and it's just fine now. So those kind of things can be prevented. And if the depredations are actively taking place, the IFT, other groups that support the reintroduction of the Mexican gray wolf, will come in and lend a hand wherever they can. We really sometimes have been painted, those of us who are pro-wolf, have at times been painted as people who would do anything for the wolf, but it's quite the opposite. We'll do anything to help the rancher. If a livestock grower is out there trying to make a living, we don't want him hurt. And we certainly don't want him to go out of business if he's pro-wolf. We want it all to work out for everybody. I don't mind sharing my public lands with anybody who treats those with respect, whether it's a livestock grower or a hunter or a wolf or whoever. I want us all to get along together out there.
Well, you know, you also mentioned husbandry practices. And I think there are a lot of folks listening to this show that might not know what is actually done in the Southwest when you put cattle out on the land. And so could you give them an idea of what really goes on?
And they might not know what goes on a dairy farm in Wisconsin either.
True, absolutely.
The husbandry practices are immensely different. In Wisconsin, of course, I grew up milking cows twice a day, 365 days a year. You didn't get a day off. There were no days off if you were milking cows. They had to come in and out of the barn twice a day. The cleanliness, I mean, it was unbelievable. Everything had to be so clean if you wanted a grade A dairy, which we held as long as I was in the farm. So yeah, the cows came in and out every day. They were cleaned. They were, you know, their feed, everything that it took to maintain those cows was 24/7 practically. It was an incredible job to raise dairy cows. Cows are kind of fragile. And then I came to New Mexico 11 years and realized that I should have been here if I was going to be raising cows, because I think it's much, much easier. You can buy your heifers in the spring, your young cows, and put them out on pasture. They graze there for months at a time. If you have water for them, that's about all they need. a pasture and some water, and you go out and check on them occasionally. And in the fall, you go out there and collect the animals that you want to take to market. I thought it seemed like a really nice way to raise cows.
Well, I guess that what I'm wondering about then is when you have the cows on the, out on the land, how do the wolves know that they're not supposed to take? How do the wolves know they're not supposed to take those cows?
Oh, that's good. Yeah, it's kind of difficult for the wolf. Wolves, as predator, their natural prey is ungulates, hooved grazing animals. So originally, they of course hunted and took Miriam's elk. A wonderful elk that is extinct, went extinct through unregulated hunting in the early years, before the wolf was gone. But now, of course, we have that giant Rocky Mountain elk, which the Lobo has figured out how to kill. It's a huge elk, and it's one of the smallest wolves in the world. I'm always stunned by that. So the wolf takes mostly elk. It'll take sheep, goats, deer, javelina. The cow is an ungulate too. So the chances of it taking a cow, I think, are less because of the kind of predator it is. Wolves are the kind of predator that wants to chase its prey. And so cows usually don't run away. They kind of stand there and graze. And I've seen them just look straight at a wolf, and the wolf will walk away because the cow doesn't run. But an elk sees a wolf, pack of wolves, even senses them close, and the first thing it does is take off. There seems to be some kind of trigger inside that predator who says, you know, catch that, that's prey, stop that. And so if it runs, they will run it down. I'm especially fond of the way they hunt. It seems kind of cruel to some people, but it's natural and it's beautiful. The pack takes off after the elk, and the first wolf that catches up with them will usually jump up on its hindquarters. Once it's sunk those long canines through the hide, it slows the elk down. And the next wolf to catch up with the encounter will run around and usually go after its nose. If you've got a wolf on your rump and you've got a wolf on your nose, you're not getting away. You're dinner. So I'm not sure why wolves even pick up on the fact that cows are edible, because they really don't run away.
Well, we're going to take a break and we'll be right back. This is Kim McCrary with the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, and you're back here with Earth Matters. And again, we're talking to Nancy Kaminsky, a veteran when it comes to wolves in the Gila, and we're going to continue with our discussion here. Nancy, there's another thing that I've heard said by some folks, and they've expressed a concern about the Mexican wolves being habituated. And of course, as you said earlier, this is a captive breeding program, and they've been releasing animals into the wild. So some folks that really don't want wolves on the landscape, or at least aren't sure about them, have talked about that being a major concern for them. I know you've spent a lot of time out there camping, and I also know you've seen wolves, and I was running after a wolf trying to see it myself, but it didn't want anything to do with me. But perhaps you could talk to our listeners a bit about your experiences on the ground.
Well, personally, I've probably seen half a dozen Mexican wolves in the wild. Many, many more timber wolves, of course, in Wisconsin. But just about every wolf I've ever seen, including our local Lobos, the minute they catch scent or sight of me, they are gone. I've never come across a habituated wolf, a wolf that was actually interested in me for anything other than a curious moment. We don't have a lot of Mexican wolves out there, and there's 7,700 square miles of recovery area, so chances of seeing any one of the 58 wolves is pretty slim. Early on in the program, I believe it was the very first wolf that was ever poached was taken by a camper. The wolf was near his campsite and curious, and the man freaked out and shot the wolf. Since that time, there's been, you know, a lot of wolves born in the wild. They're doing fine on their own if we leave them alone. More than 95% of the wolves currently in the recovery area are wild born. They've been conceived and born in the wild. They've formed their own packs. My favorite pack, of course, is the Middle Fork, just up from the cliff dwellings. They dispersed from their natal packs. They found each other in a great territory above the cliff dwellings there, hence their name, the Middle Fork. That's where they are. I mean, if you've ever been to the Meadows, you wouldn't wonder twice about why the Mexican wolf would find this perfect territory. And these wolves didn't do very well at first in trying to raise puppies. They were naive, they were new parents, and first year or two, none of the puppies survived. Now, in the last 5 or 6 years, every year they have at least 4 puppies that survived. And these two wolves are actually both 3-legged wolves. Both the alpha male and female of the Middle Fork pack have 3 legs. One was caught in a legally set trap on your public lands, and the other one was shot. But they're doing great. I mean, the wolves can do fine out there on their own. They've been doing it for years now. We have not released any new wolves in years, and so these wolves are wild. They're not habituated. Habituated is a term that I think is way overused on the Mexican wolves. I think people use it to scare other people. There's really nothing to be afraid of wolves. If you're afraid of a little 70-pound lobo, I wonder what you'd feel like if you ever encountered a timber wolf, which top out at about 120 pounds. And I talked about my volunteering for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and one of the things we did was howling surveys. So we would go out there and camp in the deep woods of northern Wisconsin by ourselves, unarmed, and we'd sit around the campfire at night and we'd howl for wolves. What was supposed to happen was that you would hear the wolves' response and you could count how many adults and how many puppies were howling. But one time, the wolf actually came to the edge of the campsite. Made me feel a little afraid at first because she was kind of on a beeline straight towards me. But of course, she was just responding to the howl. Once I realized that, I felt good about the way I learned to howl. And the minute she realized it was a human, she stopped dead in her tracks, looked a little bit shocked, and then all I saw was tail. They do not want to be around people. They know that we're pretty dangerous, and so they're smart, and they stay away from us.
Yeah, it's interesting because my experience has been very similar, having been within a natural enclosure with Mexican wolves, actually rounding them up so they could be taken to another captive facility. And when I went into the enclosure, immediately they moved as far away from all the people as they could. So your experience is very similar to mine, only mine, of course, was in a captive situation with the captive bred wolves or wolves that had been wild born and then brought back into captivity as problem animals. There is something, though, I do want to ask you about, because there are reports that wolves have come to people's homes. And some people have said they have felt, in their own word, terrorized. And I just wondered if you could talk about that a bit, just to let people know what you think is actually going on.
Well, again, as that wolf came to investigate this strange howl in her territory, wolves are very curious animals, and they must hold the territory if they're going to survive out there. Just like you have a home and a lawn that you would protect, they have to have a territory. They have to have a place where there's water and there's prey. There has to be a place for dens, to dig dens for the puppies. This is their territory. And if you're in it, they're going to go and investigate you. And the minute they see it's a human or smell it's a human, they understand that you're a pretty dangerous creature and they're going to go the other way. There was an incident, not sure of the wolf's number anymore, but I remember that it was at Crystal Diamond's house, Beaverhead Outfitters. I know Crystal and her family, and I love them all, especially her two beautiful children. And so it distressed me greatly when I heard that there was a wolf up there that had scared her children and the mom. It was a very sad thing indeed. The wolf had been one of those wolves we talked about earlier that had bred with dogs. It was in that area. It had no mate. It bred with dogs. That hybrid litter was destroyed. But that wolf was left out on the land, and no wolves were released to so that it would have a mate. So it was a sad affair for everybody. It was sad for the wolf, which couldn't find a mate, and came to Crystal's home one day and was investigating the dogs. It was not interested in her children, and I'm so sorry that it scared her or those beautiful children. In the end, the wolf did not leave immediately, and the Forest Service, actually U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, came in and killed that lonely wolf. I don't think she was interested in the children. I think she was just interested in the dogs.
Do you have any firsthand knowledge as to whether or not anyone tried to scare that animal away?
I don't remember exactly, but I'm sure the IFT, Interagency Field Team, or any of the other agencies that were involved probably spent a few days at least trying to haze the wolf away from Beaverhead. But again, if there was no other wolf for her to be with, she would have gone back repeatedly. I don't know what the resolution would have been other than to remove the wolf. She had already had a hybrid litter, and she seemed to be habituated to the dogs. And so I guess the only way to resolve that problem was to remove her one way or the other. I don't believe that she was habituated to the children. And I don't think of any of the wolves out there habituated to people. There just aren't enough people, and there aren't enough wolves out there. In order for an animal to be habituated, it has to be around people. And usually it's around people who are feeding it. If you feed a wolf, you're probably going to have problems with that wolf. The one reason that wolves are not as dangerous to humans as maybe a mountain lion would be is that they just don't see us as food. We're not what they're looking for. So if we're not food, we're probably safer with them. I would teach everybody's children how to react in predator encounters. I wouldn't be afraid of wolves. I'd teach them more about predators for, you know, the mountain lions in the area.
So, in fact, you have done a lot of teaching of younger students about wolves. And maybe it'd be nice to have you share what it is that you do teach them.
Yes, this is a great program. The Gila Conservation Education Coalition is a wonderful organization. Not sure how long we've been around, but it's been a while. And a local teacher, thought that I might do a good job all those many, many years ago of teaching the wolf trunk, a large trunk full of material that, you know, lends itself well to teaching science to children. And I've taught everything from kindergarten through high school. A lot of times I would go into Aldo Leopold High School and teach the kids how to teach the trunk so they could take it out to the grade schools. It's a wonderful, wonderful project. It is full of skulls. Kids love skulls. It's a great way to teach them how the wolves chase and bring down those giant elks I was talking about earlier. What else could I say about the wolf trunk? It is a great tool to teach the kids. The territory, teaching kids about territory is wonderful. They can understand it very well because, of course, they have territory. They have their own house. They have their own lawn. Just like the wolf needs all of this to survive, so do these kids. I think a really wonderful thing I always love about teaching the kids in this area is that the pack structure of wolves is the finest family unit, I think, on the planet. They're incredible. When the alpha male and female find each other, they mate and they have puppies, and those puppies don't leave. They stay with the family. and they're there to help with next year's litter of puppies. And that goes on for generation after generation sometimes. If the territory can't survive or can't allow the entire large pack to survive, that's when they'll disperse and then find territories of their own and start their own packs. And I think that whole idea of all the pack members working together to raise the next generation resonates in this area. I find this area to be wonderfully family-centered. And so just talking about how our family, the human family, reflects the wolves' family structure is a beautiful thing. I see children really respond to this in wonderful ways.
And that's what I wanted to ask you, in fact. How do children respond to what you teach them?
Oh, they love it. They absolutely love it.
And before we do, why don't we just take a break and we'll get back. Welcome back to Earth Matters, and we're here talking to Nancy Kaminsky. And we just started to talk about, Nancy, your teaching young students, young kids, about wolves. And I was asking you, how do they respond to what you say? Because you were describing the family structure, how similar it is to human families. How do they react when you are teaching them?
The local children are incredibly wonderful. I've had classes where the teacher next door to the class I was teaching asked to join us, and then found myself teaching 50 kids at one setting. And if those kids weren't cooperating and weren't adoring the subject and everything we're teaching them, you wouldn't be able to do it to 50 kids at a time. But they're quiet when they need to be, and they're excited about the questions and the answers. They're wonderful. At one school, Central Grade School in Santa Clara, I was doing just that. We had 50 or 60 kids and a couple of wonderful teachers. And when the recess bell rang, I stopped and nobody moved. And the teacher said, "Do you guys want to go to recess or would you like to listen to the wolf lady?" And they all stayed. Not a single child went to recess. So that gives you some kind of idea about how excited they are about learning about wolves, about learning about nature. Sometimes I go into a classroom and the children don't realize that we have the largest swath of public lands in the lower 48, just to the north of Silver City. And so, you know, enlightening these kids, seeing the smiles that come to their faces when they learn about things, you know, the wonderful wilderness we have and all the animals that live there, I find it absolutely heartwarming. I love this work. I also realized, after I've done it for a few years, it's been a while, that I was running into these people as adults, and they still remember what I taught them. I wasn't a teacher in the last life I had in Wisconsin. I certainly didn't teach children. And so it's absolutely stunning to me, the reaction that these children have to what I'm teaching them. And it sticks. They still remember facts and figures that I gave them, sometimes 5 or 6 years ago. And I think it's partly because of the actual hands-on scientific stuff that we have in these wonderful trunks. You know, they love the skulls. You can teach them a lot with a skull, a hide. We had a local taxidermist give us a coyote hide, and the children adore it. It's beautiful, it's wonderful, it's soft, and it teaches them why the animal can live in snow and cold without a house and a furnace and a blanket on his bed. I love the kids, and I think they love the wolves because of what we're teaching them.
Well, let me ask you, have any of the kids ever expressed any concern about wolves, or I mean like they're afraid of wolves?
Not really. I think the number one thing I have to do is kind of remind them that it's still a predator. You know, as much as we all love wolves, it is a predator. It's a meat eater. less likely to look at humans as prey than a few other animals around here, but it's still a predator. And so I never leave a classroom or any kind of teaching activity without reminding the kids how to react in a predator encounter.
How do you teach them that they should react if they come across a wolf?
Right. Of course, the first thing, don't run. We talked about being confused about why wolves eat cows, because cows don't run. Wolves really are triggered by the act of running away, whether it's a human or an animal. So the first thing you teach children is don't ever run. You know, if you're scared, if you're frightened of something, one of your first reactions is probably going to be get out of there. But it's the worst thing you can do in a predator encounter. You need to stand your ground, look big, throw your arms up over your head. If you got a coat, fling that around. Look big. Make noise. The more noise you can make, the more you sound like a human, something scary, the less likely that animal is going to stay. The best thing we can do for our kids, I think, is teach them about the behavior of this animal and make sure that they understand all predators can be dangerous. I would never send a small child out into the woods alone. Seems a logical thing not to do. And even I am very cautious. I go out there alone. And so if I look down at the trail and there's a large track there, I'll always put my hand in it to see how big it is. Is it big enough to be a wolf? But if I notice that it doesn't have any claw marks, I'm going to be exceptionally careful because, of course, I'm looking at a lion track. A track as big as a wolf, 4 to 4.5 inches, you know, tall, that doesn't have claw marks is much more dangerous. A lion could be standing right above me. And that makes me a little bit more cautious. But
you know, I should let you know, because I've never told you this, Nancy, but I actually have been involved in lion research in California with a colleague of mine. And we were very lucky, even though they were radio collared. We actually only saw them twice. We were begging to see them more, but it was definitely hard to do. Although I do agree with you that people need to be very mindful. You know, when you're in an area where there are predators, I suppose as an aside, I just like to say that I'm a lot more concerned about the two-legged critter, by and large, than I am the four-legged critter. Now, that aside, I did want to follow up on this idea of fearing wolves. That's something that people that oppose their presence on the ground express, and that is that they're very fearful of wolves for their children and for themselves. Do you think that this fear is something that's hyped, real, a mixed bag? I mean, do people genuinely fear the wolves that are living with them, or what? I'm just kind of want to get a sense of what you think
right. The
situation is.
The situation in areas within the Mexican wolf reintroduction zone are a little dicey. Shall we call it dicey? There are people out there, I believe, are truly afraid of the wolf. I'd like to spend more time in those areas teaching that wolf trunk, because I think education would help these people with their fears. There are also those who would like people to be afraid, because they can use that as a tool to make the lobo look bad. The worst part about children being afraid, anybody being afraid, is that reaction, of course, to run. But there's worse things happening to the children once all of this fear has been repeated day after day after day after day. One of my favorite hobbies is actually human psychology. And so when I first heard about some of the things that were happening out there with the children, I was very distressed and immediately set about to research the subject. I don't want to be telling people to do something that's not good for their children. And so I was very careful about it. But what I found was that in human psychology, when you have something you fear, you shouldn't remove it. That's not going to resolve that fear. What you have to do is bring the person closer to what they fear and educate them about it, make them understand it. Don't put them in danger, but at the same time teach them how to respond to that predator.
Well, Nancy, you know, we've been talking about Mexican wolves and the recovery efforts, and we are going to have to wrap up here soon. And I'd really like you to share with our listeners what you think needs to be done to move Mexican wolf recovery efforts forward.
Oh, loaded question.
Absolutely. I'm not going to let you get off easy, all right.
You know how I hate to take sides.
I know.
I guess I've always been for direct releases from captive breeding facilities of Mexican wolves into New Mexico. I think a lot of people don't realize that they cannot be directly released into New Mexico at this time. They have to go from captive breeding facilities on the ground in Arizona, and then they either disperse into New Mexico or they can be moved here by the interagency field team. So I think it would really help if we would put them in New Mexico directly. We have better habitat for them over here than Arizona does anyway.
Do I detect a bias?
No, not me. More releases in general. I mean, we haven't released a wolf from captive breeding facilities since November of 2008. We're not surprised that wolves can't find mates out there when we haven't put any out on the land. So I guess, you know, how would the average person know how to, you know, ask anybody to do this? If you were going to help me, I would ask you to join local groups. New Mexico Wild, of course, would be one of my first choices. If you can't afford to join the group, you could just go to their website, and they provide alerts on different things you can take action on. Other local groups such as Audubon, the Gila Conservation Coalition, Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, all these groups do more than just what their name might suggest and actively help with this reintroduction of the Mexican gray wolf.
Nancy, the show has actually come to an end, but before we sign off here, I just wanted to ask you, do you have any closing comment you'd like to make?
Oh boy, you know, it wasn't originally my idea to move to New Mexico, but I'm kind of glad I did now. I've always been a lover of wild lands, complete with all its wild creatures. I had accomplished a lot in Wisconsin, and I think moving to Mexico has given me another opportunity to accomplish even more on behalf of the wild lands that I love so much. Thanks.
Well, I just want to say thank you to you, and it has been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. And I also want to thank you, the listeners, for listening to Earth Matters, a show about earthly matters that impact us all.